And welcome to the final edition of the 2017 Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Joining me today, my co-host, Mark Harrington. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Mark, of course, one of our Friday film reviewers and a big fan, I know, of Sundance. Have you had a good one so far?
I have. I always enjoy just the diversity of opportunity to hear all the different stories that come out from all parts of the world, and you know that's what it's all about.
Yeah. So, what did you focus on this year? Anything in particular?
I usually focus more on documentaries, but this year I literally went across the board. I filled, as many of us do that have full time jobs and families, time slots more than choices of what I wanted to see. So I got to see a little bit of everything, and I really got lucky with my picks and everything from premieres to documentaries to shorts. So
well, and I was going to say, I mean, do you feel like you get lucky? I mean, or is it just everything's pretty okay, right?
Oh, well, absolutely. The quality of the films has really progressed over the years. I mean, you always used to have that fear, particularly, you know, where you just go in, am I going to get that just really crazy film that they picked because they want to give that voice to that unheard perspective that's just crazy. And you're like, what did they pick that? You know, the spoof of the Simpsons episode where they pick the films comes to mind. But it's hard to go wrong these days. The quality of the films has been elevated. The competition's so stiff. Would hate to be a filmmaker trying to get in these days. I mean, the number of submissions is just outrageous. And so, but the good news for the audience is the quality's great.
Yeah. So some of the highlights for you then?
Well, in the premiere category, I was really blown away by Mudbound, another strong film adaptation of a novel. Post-World War II Mississippi, returning black vet comes back and has to interact with a family that's going through its own kind of survival in a small farm, and just brings together, and I think it really connects well with another film we'll be talking about later in the program, Tell Them We Are Rising, because a lot of the documentary issues raised in that film are embodied by the characters of Mudbound, with a just fantastic cast as Jason Mitchell as the vet, Rob Morgan as his sort of mediator father, kind of the Booker T. Washington perhaps, but that could be debated. Jason Clark as, you know, someone that's trying to bridge the gap between his family's past a very bigoted slave owner history that's kind of embodied by his father, who's played by the always brilliant Jonathan Banks as his pappy. And so this whole cross-section of interaction with the backdrop of Mississippi Mud, just really, really brilliant film. The other one I really liked, I don't want to steal Sean Mean's thunder because I think he wrote about it this morning, Wind River, locally shot here in Utah. Big fan of Taylor Sheridan, the writer and director, making his directorial debut in this film. Got a little criticism, I think, on some of his interior shots in particular and some of his sound editing. That didn't bother me as much. To me, he is the master of the small conversation, the peripheral conversation, and that's where his films, Hell or High Water, the waitress scenes, the scenes in the doorway. Similarly here, the interaction with a main character who is a fish and wildlife game hunter as he deals with his own past grief, helping a family that suffers a horrific loss. In this, the dialogue wasn't as snappy, but it was just really, there were some scenes that were just searing. And I think he represents a hope for, I think, what mainstream media is missing in this national political discussion today. And I've talked about this with Rick a lot in the terms of Hell or High Water, and that is the empathy for the people who are disenfranchised and poor, regardless of race, color, place, poverty, or cause, is not being addressed. And that is a place where if we can, as we did in sort of post-marching 60s, where the coalitions focused on the war on poverty to bridge the gap between civil rights progress and the sort of political chaos. I think that is where I, you know, as a pragmatic local government person as well, I think we'd be better served focusing on, because those stories, those governance isn't just up now, it's down. And I think this is 49% of people who vote are themselves government. And if you can't relate and convince them, you will not be successful in government. A lot of these side stories in Sheridan's films address that perspective. And I think those are the hidden gems in his films, not necessarily the action. The action in the third act was brilliant in terms of a very chaotic ending. But that's not what draws me to his films. On the short film category, the awards came out already. The top two were my two favorite, and so we put Goldfish in the Pool. This was just a really well-executed, fast-paced film about some local schoolgirls in a small village that put goldfish in the pond of their school. And what seems like a pretty simple, irrelevant story really turned into something that compressed a rapid-fire script that maintains a real smart narrative integrity and doesn't sacrifice sort of any intellectual curiosity or poignancy that you often see sacrificed with slapstick humor in some of these coming-of-age stories.
Did you see that as part of the shorts program?
At the award, I went to the
awards.
And then the other one, two that really stood out were Broken, also relates kind of from an opposite perspective to the other film we're going to talk about today, Machines, because it was just the opposite of Machines. It depicted the horrors of a political prisoner camp from a women's perspective in East Germany by narrating their journals and interviews with a backdrop of sketches of the schematics of the prison. So it was dialogue driven with very little visual reference, whereas Machines, 100% the opposite. So really interesting contrast there. The other film that I thought everyone walked away with was Lapse, in terms of just searing minimalist description of sexual assault on a subway. And you just, almost no dialogue and just searing. So those were just great finds.
Good. Well, we're going to get to our first interview. We'll be talking with the director of the documentary that you talked about, World Documentary Machines. You're listening to the Sundance Reel on KPCW.
Support for KPCW comes from the Wasatch Brew Pub, offering weekend brunch at the top of Main Street, featuring traditional favorites as well as midday Marys and mimosas. Private event space available. Wasatch Brew Pub. We drink our share and sell the rest. WasatchBeers.com. The Sundance Reel is brought to you in part by Mark Miller Subaru. Love the experience.
G'day, Ian from Campos Coffee. We're new to Park City and a supporter of KPCW. At Campos, we source our beans direct from the farmers and invest in social projects in all our farming communities. Our coffee blends are roasted in small batches and delivered each day. Campos Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, camposcoffee.com.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. Leslie Thatcher here along with my co-host, Mark Harrington. Well, after watching the World Documentary Machines, you'll give a second thought to everything made from fabric in the studio with us to tell us more about what he found in the Indian textile sweatshops and documented in his film Machines is the director, Rahul Jain. Good morning to you and thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. A very good morning to you.
So you were born in India, I guess, so aware of what was going on in these textile mills? I mean, or knew somebody part of it? Or?
Yes, I did have distant familial connections to get me inside this factory. And, growing up, every summer I was able to get inside here because my maternal grandfather owned something like this, which is now defunct. And he lived right above the factory, so I could sneak into the factory as a child, and I accumulated a lot of perceptions there. But, you know, for children, like, memory is not written down or pointed out. It's just like a mixture of everything put together. So as an adult, I just went back to explore this.
Yeah, so you were, I mean, the owner said, sure, come on in. I guess I'm thinking it's not something they really wanted you to see.
Well, I did tell them that I want to show the world how you're giving people so many jobs.
And so, they are.
And they are, exactly. It is a situation you can look at it from two different perspectives, you know, that either, you know, these people get jobs or either that their lives are completely taken away from them. And it is a total version of modern slavery.
And that's what I want to, my question to you is, I mean, after watching this, I really didn't know whether I should stop buying unnecessary clothing because I don't want to contribute to treating people like slaves, or whether I buy more to make sure that they have a job. Where do you come down on that?
I mean, reality is really not black and white. And I went in the factory with a lot of questions, and by the time I came out, I only had more conflicts and more contradictions. There are so many shades between the blacks and whites, and you know, exactly, it's the same problem for me too, to think, should I buy this, should I not buy this? You know, everything that we're wearing here is nothing is made here. And at the end of the day, the person responsible for labor is the real making of it is actually not getting that much money at all. They're possibly making $2-3 a day, and in that day they possibly make 30-40 jackets, which we buy for $200-$300 each. So when we do the math, there is like this huge amount of profit that is going somewhere. And I don't know how to work like an activist, and I that's why I made this movie.
And I think that's where I think some of the audience felt the sledgehammer of the end, where they thought they were just going to watch this visceral depiction, and in some ways the most truest form of documentary filmmaking, because you use very little dialogue and you show what you see, and with these brilliant contrasts of conditions, color, black, white. The color of the fabric is just beautiful to watch. But then, of course, at the end, where there is some interaction between you're displaying them filming, the one person filming you, the questioning, you know, the ministers can't do anything. What are you going to do, audience or filmmaker or whomever? And brings it back to, okay, no, this is going to be a question. And I think it translates to many, obviously, forms of documentaries today. So in terms of, do you think it achieved, did you arrive somewhere different than you expected at the end, or was that your plan all along?
Well, many filmmakers who I appreciate have said that a film is a naked filmmaker. You know, you're really seeing what they are made of, almost, because I'm almost giving you my whole mental brain map. And yes, I did grow up with this kind of thinking every day, and it's difficult to think that you're paying for a bottle of wine the same amount of money that the guy who dropped you to the hotel is making in a month or 2 months. And it's a very simple question that a child or an adult can ask, and it's kind of even become normalized in the kind of class divided country that I come from, India, where you don't understand how money works, because it's, you know, some people have so much of it to splurge on, and then some people have so little of it. And yeah, it just makes you question the everyday.
Yeah, the plant manager is definitely normalized. He's like, hey, these are ignorant people that deserve what they get, and I give them opportunity up to a certain point. If I give them too much, I work against my own interest. He wasn't apologetic by any stretch.
And that is the story for more than half the country's privileged people. You know, you have to almost like anesthetize your empathy and not deal with it, just so you can thrive, whatever thriving means to you in that context.
Well, I wanted to slap him, but besides that scene, another one that just really took me off guard was the poor young boy who could barely stay awake during his shift. And I just think, I mean, how old was he? 11, 12 years old?
He was 12.
And forced to work there?
No, not forced to work. He was very happy to work there. And that's the inherent contradiction of the situation. To our eyes, this is absolute drudgery and cruelty, and nothing could be more diabolical than this. But to this kid, he is blessed to have a job. He is blessed to be able to make money autonomously, independent of his parents, and actually even send them some back home. So it's just that, you know, the way that global economy works is such a non-understandable way for somebody ignorant like me. And that's why I can just raise these questions. And maybe, you know what, an economist can sit me down and explain to me everything in numbers. But I don't think in numbers. I think in feelings. And what people might call or consider normal is not normal, you know, like just like a child who questions everything. I think it's necessary, you know, the same kind of curiosity for the nonfiction filmmaker.
Yeah. And final question then, you've got in terms of unionization, I mean, that just is not a reality in India?
It's not only not just a reality, but it's also been really heavily propagandized against. So somebody who's gone to school till the age of never, you know, they are easily manipulated into thinking that unions are bad for you. They take a little bit of your money and give you nothing in return. It is the unions that are projected to be fascist-like, which is a total opposite of the reality. But it's just, that's how, I guess, manipulation works, and we are all subjected to it today.
Well, I think you've got a screening ongoing, right, as we speak, at Laird Prospector, so too late to see it, but an opportunity to see it some other time in the future?
I really think so. We're looking at many possible avenues of theatrical distribution and then video on demand services. Of course, it is such a visual and cinematic film, you would do really well to go see it in the theater. But even if you don't, it is something that I highly ask you and implore you to look at. It's a tough watch, but if I was young and if I got to see this, my world would really change. So, you know, I ask you guys to do the same.
All right. Well, thank you for your time this morning and beautiful job on the film.
Great job.
Thank you so much.
That's director Raul Jain. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW. We'll be back with film critic Sean Means from the Salt Lake Tribune.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital with New Park Town Center. With urban amenities and services and home to restaurants, shops, entertainment, lodging, and residences. More information about New Park Town Center at 801-303-5440.
Support for KPCW is provided by Sundance Institute, a nonprofit organization. The Sundance Film Festival is proud to call Utah home, with screenings this January 19th through January 29th in Park City, Salt Lake City, and Sundance Resort. The festival's home state is as important to its identity as its filmmakers. Don't miss the world premieres of the best in independent film, along with live music, virtual reality, panel discussions, and more. More information at sundance.org/locals.
It's 9:24. Good morning. This is the Sundance Reel. Well, over the last 10 days, Sean Means, the Salt Lake Tribune's film critic, has spent a lot of time in dark theaters or behind a computer covering the Sundance Film Festival. We always like to end the Sundance Reel with a look at some of the highlights from Sean. He joins us now in the studio. Thanks so much for being here, Sean.
Good morning.
So your goal always to see the competition films, at least, the dramatic and documentary.
Mm-hmm.
32 of them. Did you get to all of them?
I have seen all of the U.S. dramatic competition, finished the checklist last night, and I've got four more to go on the documentaries.
And you'll have time to see
those? Three today and one tomorrow.
Great. All right. Well, then give us the highlights then.
Well, I mean, the best movie I think I've seen in the dramatics was Patty Cakes, a very funny, very sweet comedy about a white girl rapper in New Jersey who wants to sort of prove herself and get out of her humdrum New Jersey existence.
Played by an Australian?
That was the biggest shock for the audience after the movie was over. Because the movie is a lot of fun and has a great sort of inspirational ending to it. And it brought the house down. I mean, the Eccles, they just went nuts for it. Screaming, yelling, clapping, cheering, ovations, standing ovations, and so on. And then in the Q&A, they brought the cast out, and the filmmaker brought the cast out and gave her the mic, and she starts talking, and you realize, oh my gosh, she's Australian.
All right. Well, I saw you midweek, and at that point, Wind River had been your favorite. Mm-hmm. So this Patty Cakes tops that, or what's number two?
Well, Wind River is definitely up there. It's not in competition, so it's sort of a different kettle of fish in a way. But Wind River, great crime thriller with some underlying messages to it. Directed by Taylor Sheridan, this is his third screenplay, and his first two were Sicario and Hell or High Water. So, I mean, this guy's got a track record. He knows what he's doing. Hell or High, and matter of fact, while he was here, on Tuesday, he was awakened to the news that he got an Oscar nomination for Hell or High Water for in the original screenplay category. This one could do the same again next year. This one is he's really good at doing under the guise of a crime thriller, getting into big issues. In this case, it's life on the Indian reservation. You get it. The story is about a fish and wildlife hunter played by Jeremy Renner who gets asked to help out with a murder investigation by this rookie FBI agent who's played by Elizabeth Olsen. And the murder involves a woman from the Indian reservation. It's all set in Wyoming, but it was all filmed actually here in Utah. Actually filmed around Park City. And other places. I think they use the Park City Studios.
Oh wow.
Actually. So good cast. Renner gives a really good it's funny cuz you know Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen, most people would mainstream moviegoers know them as two members of the Avengers. So it's kind of fun to see them in a different setting, and it's a really strong movie, but like I said, really gets into some stuff under the guise of a crime thriller.
Okay, and number three then for Dramatics before we hit the docs.
Icarus Icarus, again a crime thriller sort of a spy thriller in documentary form. Starts out with the filmmaker Brian Fogel. He is trying to sort of investigate the way sports doping works, particularly with cyclists and particularly with Lance Armstrong. And the way he decides to do this is to go the Super Size Me route, because he's an amateur cyclist himself, and he decides to basically try the doping regimen that Lance Armstrong tried and see if he could see if it would improve his performance and see if he could get away with it and fool the testing the way Lance Armstrong did. And that's where it starts. And then as he gets into it and winds up befriending the head of the anti-doping lab in Moscow, which is overseen by the Russian government, which means it's overseen by Vladimir Putin, things take a very alarming turn into the movie. So.
Yeah. Well, and that I was kind of curious whether or not, because this guy is, I mean, I guess, am I spoiling anything if I talk about what happens to Gregory? I don't want to wreck it for anybody. But I guess, I mean, he could have been there watching this, but then we wouldn't have known it.
Right. Well, I ran into one of the writers of the film yesterday at a different screening, and I asked, because I saw it in a press and industry screening, so I didn't get to see it with all the usual hoopla of Q&As and whatnot. But I did ask. I said, was he here? And he said, oh no, we don't even know where he is.
Okay, that's interesting. So. Yeah. Some other docs that just kind of rose to the top of your scale?
One of the ones I really liked was Unrest, because it hit a subject that I think a lot of us don't know a lot about, and what they do know they think is a joke, which is chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME. It's a big long Latin name or Greek name that I can't pronounce. But the filmmaker Jennifer Brea, she suffers from chronic fatigue syndrome, and it's so debilitating for her that she could do a day where she's working semi-normally, and then she crashes and she has to spend 2 or 3 days in bed. There are a million people in the United States and several million around the world who have this same issue, and she manages to interview a lot of them, several people who have dealt with this. Doing the interviews via Skype from her own bedroom because she can't get up and out to go do them, and explores both how how stigmatized this disease is, because a lot of people think it's a joke, think it's not real, even the medical profession thinks it's a psychological disorder, and in some countries like Denmark, the policy is to institutionalize chronic fatigue patients and take them away from their families, because the families are seen as coddling them somehow and you know, buying into their psychological disorder. It's a really beautifully done movie because she's documenting, you know, she's documenting the thing that is striking her at the same time she's trying to show that it's not just her, that it is a worldwide thing.
Yeah, and there was a scene there that, that showed really how that the husband of a woman with this comes full circle in terms of, I mean, when his daughter gets it. And it's like, I mean, I think he'd left the wife. He'd had pretty much enough, and yet then when he sees the daughter with the same affliction, it was just like, oh my gosh. And I thought that was a really tender way of a great scene just in that whole story. But, you know, it was interesting how I think I remember him saying that more people are afflicted with chronic fatigue syndrome than with MS.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, is that these people are just invisible because they're in their beds.
Right.
They just you just don't know about them.
Yeah, you don't see them out on the street because they can't get out to the street. Oh. They're, you know. And it's not, you know. Also, the fact that MS, for many years, MS had the same sort of stigma that it was an in-your-head sort of thing, until there was enough scientific proof to show that it wasn't. One of the keys with chronic fatigue is showing enough scientific proof to convince the doubters that, yeah, this is for real.
Yeah, and it affects more women, many more women than it does with men. And it was interesting how they. How it used to be defined as hysteria or hypochondria.
Right.
Again, so just kind of these mental aspects.
And again, the sort of sexist nature of the medical community, you know, sort of played into that for many years as well. So,
Okay. What else?
What else? A couple of the dramatics that I really liked. One is Novitiate, really powerful drama set in 1964 in a convent, following the young nuns in training. And at a very particular time, because it was right at the time that the Vatican II Council had finished up and was instituting reforms in the church to sort of modernize the church, which had good and bad effects for the nuns in the Catholic community. This is one of the stronger sort of movies about the nature of faith. It doesn't mock the idea of faith, which happens too frequently. But it's got a great young cast. It's a sort of thing where you're going to look at this cast 5 years from now and go, oh wow, all these young women, young actresses who 5 years from now are going to be all doing something big. They were all in this movie together. So that's another one.
So it sounds like the opposite of The Little Hours at Midnight.
This is not the funny nun.
Not the funny nun movie.
It's the not funny nun movie, as we got referring to it in the lines sometimes.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to see Dolores?
Yes, I did. And not only did I get to see the movie, I got to see Dolores herself out in the rally on Saturday morning.
Yeah. So wasn't that surprising to see she's all of maybe 5 feet?
Right. And she could still kick my butt. I don't know.
86 years old.
86 years old. I think she could take me down. Yeah. And she, Dolores Huerta, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers, often her role in history is often sort of set aside, you know, because in the legend making of that has happened with Cesar Chavez. But Dolores was the one, you know, in the trenches getting the organizing done and is still out there fighting. And the movie shows that as well. So the movie also shows the sort of sacrifices to her family. I mean, she had 11 kids. She had seven kids by the time she was starting the UFW, had four more in a relationship with Cesar's brother, Richard. And, you know, the kids paid a toll in some way, they sort of had to share her with the world and with the cause.
Yeah, I did see that with her talking afterwards, and she talked about, yeah, but I've raised some very tough kids who, you know, can stand on their own. So, you know, yeah, it's it that was that was hard to see.
I mean, several of her kids are in the movie, and I mean,
and
obviously,
for her, or for the foundation,
and obviously that there, you know, there's been a reconciliation.
Sure.
Of sorts. So.
Well, and we also have to mention, because this was something I didn't know, of course, President Obama's phrase, "Yes, we can," actually came from Dolores. Si se puede.
Yeah. Was her phrase. As it shows in the movie, when Dolores got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, President Obama, you know, owned up to, I borrowed that from her, and she says it's okay.
Well, something Mark and I were talking about earlier before you came on, I mean, in terms of just this feel for this year's festival, I mean, we were just saying it's hard to go and see a bad film anymore.
It's
getting, that your sense?
I have heard about movies that were massive walkouts. There's a midnight movie called Cuso. That I have heard is just grotesque and strange, and a lot of people walked out of. It's directed by the musician who goes by the name Flying Lotus, and it's supposed to be really weird.
And then there's Raw that I mean, I read it, it's like, absolutely not. I would never go
right,
right.
subject
on,
myself.
It's the Midnight series. Make your bed, sleep in it.
Yeah.
You know?
Here's the thing. The Midnight series has always been one of the more sort of up and down aspects of the festival. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, you've had you know, the Saw franchise started at the Midnight program, because the original Saw played at Sundance. Blair Witch Project was a Midnight movie at Sundance. Rumble in the Bronx was a Midnighter at Sundance. So, you know, you never know. But you do get a lot of weirdness. One of my worst movies of the entire year last year, I didn't see it here at the festival, but it did come back around in Salt Lake, was The Greasy Strangler, which was trying so hard to be a John Waters movie, it couldn't see straight. And it's a reminder that, you know, only John Waters can get away with some things, and sometimes not even then.
Yeah. Well, and certainly a big topic this year was the introduction of the new climate program. Mm-hmm. What do you think? I mean, was this an afterthought given the presidential election, or should we really believe them as we've been told? It just came to them because of the films that
No, I think this is, I mean, obviously, I mean, you know, Robert Redford's been, you know, a bona fide environmentalist for decades. That's genuine. That, you know, and I think they from the summer, they had already been talking about, you know, the environment and how they want to get in, you know, get involved in trying to do something to sort of move the conversation, to move the needle a little bit. And then, as luck would have it, some of these great movies came along just as they were going. I mean, I take them at their word when they say that this was something that was in the works before the movies started landing on their doorstep. And yeah, you've got movies like Chasing Coral or the Al Gore sequel, that are bringing us back around to the, oh yeah, this is a major problem, we have to do something about it. I think there was a certain urgency that came about after November 8th, when everybody, you know, when I think there was some complacency on the side of you know, the climate change side, that, oh, it'll be fine, Hillary will be president and we'll be able to carry on as we've been carrying on. And then, oh yeah, that didn't happen. The other guy got in, and I think generally that's been a sort of an interesting thing to watch at the festival. Generally, is how many documentaries went through very sudden and drastic re-edits after November 8th, because you know, Mr. Trump does show up in quite a few documentaries in this festival. So whether he's the main subject or not.
So is that just a one-year thing, or is that something you think we'll see carry on?
I'm going to be very curious to see what the documentary landscape is after this year, because at next year's festival. Because after living a full year of the new administration, I would imagine there's a lot of filmmakers. First off, there's going to be a lot of filmmakers who are going to be scrambling for funding, because if they're worried that they're not going to get any NEA grants, if the Republicans get their way. But I think there is going to be, you know, as Redford said, I think, you know, that when there is something this sort of such a big effect, I mean, it's almost, you know, I liken it to a natural disaster. I like, you know, it's like a hurricane has hit in this community. And it's going to be interesting to see how they react to it. And I think there's going to be, you know, like Redford said, there's a stirrings of a movement that is going to be, you know, resisting whatever is coming out of the White House right now, and coming out of the Republican side. And there are everybody's on the side that is doing these documentaries. I think they're all very much awake and very much aware and very much eager to sort of, you know, like I said, show their resistance.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, just since we've got three people here, an attorney and a couple journalists, about the you wanted to mention.
Well, I think the one area we haven't discussed is, and it correlates to this directly, are the panel discussions, because I think that's the other thing which Redford really wants to incubate and sees actually as the more important part of the festival, now that because he has his own conflict with the market position of the festival and the impacts on us, and that we're too big and vice versa. But the integrity of his festival, I think, lies in this exact discussion. And I think it was best exemplified by the Observer Effect panel, which was a relatively small panel. I think it was primarily for industry invite only, unfortunately, but hopefully it's out there somewhere. But that it was from the director, I think it was a combination from the documentary group at Sundance and another sponsor. But it asked that very question, is what is the form of this genre moving forward? And in a very, you know, I was more like the liberal hillbilly, you know, person in the audience there, not quite qualified to be there. But I think that is on everyone's mind, is what is going to be the role of this? And even one panelist asked the question, you know, have we made Trump more normalized or given him a different vehicle by making nonfiction such a politicized and form of art that the other side can use to convince people to go the other way? And that's an oversimplification of the discussion, but I think the answer is no, but I think the danger is certainly there. And so I think someone like David Shields' book, you know, Reality Hunger, and his perspective on, you know, genre is a minimum security prison. That's one of my favorite quotes from him. And that, you know, documentaries are going to have to be careful how they portray themselves moving forward as objective, just reality, as opposed to a scripted perspective. And I think as we use art and film or employ them to change our perspective or change others' perspective, it's going to be very tricky to retain that authenticity of identity if it's not overt and almost out there as part of the message, instead of just say, hey, this is truth. Because we are in, you know, I don't like the phrase post-truth, but in order to have validity, you're going to have to have more effort and disclosure of your source and your perspective and what you're trying to do. And I think that's a new reality.
Yeah. Yeah. So finally, just in terms of the Tribune's effort to cover Sundance, I mean, they make a big deal of it. We don't see the D News up here. We seem even less, it seems like, with Channel 5. So it seems like you're the local media that's into it. Why is that? I mean, what's the your publisher's view on that?
Well, I mean, this is something, you know, we've been doing for many years. I've been this is my 24th year covering the festival, and then my predecessor covered it since the, you know, from when it was conceived, and you know, we take this very seriously. First off, it is, you know, the largest, in some ways, the largest cultural event in the state every year. It certainly draws draws some of the biggest out of town audience, you know, 30,000 out of towners plus the, you know, thousands local who take part in it. It's a major economic engine. It's a major, you know, tourist draw. It is a major publicity machine for the state. You know, it's all those things. It's also you know, the incubator for a lot of what happens in the culture, for, you know, in movies and beyond. And it's all happening right in our backyard. So we'd be, I think we'd be foolish if we didn't get up here and try to, you know, blow it out as best we could.
Yeah. Well, we need to leave it at that, Sean. Okay. Again, thanks for your time and your coverage of Sundance Film Festival. We'll look forward to talking to you again next year.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise grants and donations focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our local communities. Grants fund programs that are designed to help kids achieve in the classroom and develop an interest for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and our employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
Support for KPCW comes from Mark Miller Subaru, celebrating their green initiative, promoting the preservation and protection of the planet through sustainable business practices, building strong community relationships to create a cleaner and safer environment for future generations. More at markmillersubaru.com.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host, Mark Harrington. In just a minute, we'll be checking in with documentary Stanley Nelson, talking about his film, Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of black colleges and universities. Any other thoughts, Mark, while we wait for...
Well, no, I think, you know, Sean represents some of the, obviously, the best of the critical writing that's going on today. And that's the other part that this panel is not just the effect that I was referring to, not just the effect of documentaries, but the importance of the continuation of critical essayists and writing about film and how that art form itself influences the art. And I think that's going to be very important moving forward, because I think as much as this political crisis is one that's very complex, there's also a sort of anti-intellectualism that underlies this current crisis. And I think we can't be afraid to continue to particularly with all the media outlets from forums to support and continue the hard dialogue and ask the hard questions from a critical perspective and not just a combat perspective, a point of view. And that's going to be very important to move forward.
Right. You can't get anywhere if you don't talk.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, veteran documentary Stanley Nelson returns to Sundance with another chapter of American history and his film, Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of black colleges and university. He joins us now in the studio. Good morning and welcome back to KPCW.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
So these are known as HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. I haven't seen the film, so I don't even know where to begin here. I mean, tell me what they are and why a film is about them.
Oh, so this is a film that gives almost 170 years of history in 85 minutes. It's a story about black colleges and universities, which until, you know, the early 70s, late 60s was pretty much the only place that African Americans could go to college. And so it tells the story of their development and through different stories, through different chapters in their history.
And it's because they couldn't get into other colleges and universities because there were black people were not allowed into them, really?
Right. So in the South, where the majority of the black population lived and still lives, they weren't allowed into the schools. In the North, there were quotas. If black people were allowed into schools, there were quotas. So there were quotas in every place from Michigan to Harvard, Yale, Stanford, whatever.
Yeah. So where was the first one?
That's kind of in dispute. There were a couple of schools, Lincoln and a couple of others, that started before the Civil War in the North. So the vast majority of black colleges are in the South. There's still today just slightly over 100 black colleges that exist. But after the Civil War, after 1865, there was just an explosion of black colleges. And so by the turn of the century, there were 90 black colleges or so.
So is it still segregated that much? I mean, are these colleges are open to everyone?
Yeah, the black colleges have always been open to everyone. They've been open to everyone, but they were mainly a place that black people could go to school. Mm-hmm. So what's happening today is there's been a shrinkage of the schools because black people can go to other places. The other thing that that happens and we show in the film is that if you were a black professor, these were the only places that you could teach also. So what's happened now is, you know, if you're the star professor, you can teach at any college. You're recruited to teach at Harvard, Yale, Stanford, wherever, Michigan, wherever. So there's been a kind of a drain of the kind of star professors, you know, at black colleges, and also a drain of some of the students. But they, a lot of colleges still exist. Some of the colleges, the public colleges in the South, are becoming white because white people can go, and these are colleges, and they're changing. There's also a bunch of colleges that have a much more of a Hispanic population than they used to. So things are changing.
And I did see the film, and I thought a couple of the more interesting points were obviously the speakers that you interviewed's perspective on Booker T. Washington. And has that generated, you know, discussion, or is that, that seemed to be a pretty strong position to come out in terms of, obviously there's always been mixed interpretations of his success, and obviously as a politician, more so than an educator, but to put it in the perspective of whether his vocational track was actually harmful to such a degree was a strong position in the film.
Yeah. I mean, I should say that the question of debate about Booker T. Washington, the film premiered on Monday, so the film has actually been shown, I think, three times. Okay. Up until now. So yeah, we've got a lot of questions. Booker T. Washington took over Tuskegee in the late 1900s and became the most powerful black man, the most famous black man in the country, which is telling, even because he was the head of a college, you know. So I would challenge anyone to name a president, sure, of a black college today. You can't even name one. He was the most powerful black man in the country. And what Booker T. Washington advocated was industrial education for black people. You know, he advocated for black people to kind of start at the bottom and work their way up. And as someone in the film says, you could almost call it a neo-slavery. He really advocating for black people to be in service positions, that's where we should start. And so that's how he's portrayed in the film. He becomes a real subject of controversy even in those days. W.E.B. Du Bois, who someone says is the most educated man, white or black, in America. W.E.B. Du Bois went to Harvard, mm-hmm, then goes on to study in Berlin. He's you know, without a doubt a genius. And W. Du Bois just challenges Booker T. and says, "No, we should be educated as African Americans for higher pursuits, not to be of subservient roles to whites." And it becomes this real kind of clash of mm-hmm, titans back at the turn of the century.
So when we see the three brilliant stars of the current film, Hidden Figures, I mean, were they educated at these?
I'm not sure exactly, but my guess would be yes. I mean, you know, 95% of black people before the 70s who went to college went to black college. So black college were really the kind of engine for the black middle class. That's one of the pieces in the film.
Yeah. Do they? But as you say, as they kind of start to drain into the other colleges, I mean, are we going to lose them? I mean, are they going to become irrelevant or?
You know, that's funny because at a screening yesterday, someone asked that, and I said, "Yeah, in a perfect world, yes, but we're so far away from that perfect world that's not going to happen anytime soon." I think that they will shrink. There's 100 schools now. My guess would be, you know, in 20 years there'll be 80 or you know, something like that. They will shrink. But the last chapter in the film we call Today, and we profile three students who are in college today. And one of the things that they talk about is that this is a place where they feel safe to talk about issues. This is the only black intellectual space in this country. What we do show in the film is that social movements have been launched at black colleges. So the sit-in movement, the mm-hmm, whole desegregation of stores in the South was started because four black students were in their dorm talking about the situation and said, "We got to do something." And they just went and sat in. And then it exploded across the South. largely through black colleges. So that's another piece of what black colleges are. It's not only a place to be educated, but also a place where African Americans can talk about the issues that face them.
Yeah, I think to say you covered a lot of ground in 87 minutes or whatever is an understatement. I think there's several films within a film here, and I think The Returning Vets is its own film and the violence they face. And I don't know if you've seen the dramatic film Mudbound, but a lot of, you know, direct corollary with that narrative, or read that book. But you give a lot more of you make it clear the magnitude that was. It wasn't isolated in this town or that town, but just that degree. And similarly, with some of these other stories, one story you did not include, and I'm wondering if this is a conscious decision, is the current debate about whether, you know, black houses on more mainstream universities is a good or bad idea, or that debate. Was that a conscious choice to stay away from that?
Well, we felt we had to stay away from any story of black people in what's called majority white institutions. Mm-hmm. That's another story. And that's a story that can be told.
132 years, 87 minutes wasn't enough. We want it all.
Yeah, so I think that the issues that faced African Americans and still face African Americans who go to a majority white institutions, you know, that's another story, and there is a story there. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, for us, we had to kind of figure out some way to keep it in a box.
That makes sense.
To keep it so that we could tell the story that we tell.
So the majority of these schools, private or public?
The majority are public. I think 65% are public, 35% are private. So what happened in the South, as the college system was being set up in the South at the turn of the century and beyond, so when University of Alabama was formed, it was formed as a segregated school. Black people couldn't go. And so what they did was that we were in a time of separate but equal. So they set up black college campuses in Alabama. And that existed all through the South. I mean, you know, we talk about a story in Oklahoma where that was all, you know, so it's not just the Deep South. Oklahoma also was a segregated system. We tell a story there where during the fight to integrate these schools, Thurgood Marshall, who later became a Supreme Court justice, was fighting the segregated policies in Oklahoma, and he gets a black man who was actually a 68-year-old retired guy who already had a master's into Oklahoma University to get a PhD. And they sue, and Oklahoma says, okay, fine, you can come to Oklahoma, but they make him sit outside the classroom. So there are these beautiful pictures of this guy, and he's sitting like
he's
in
like
the
looking
door
in from the window outside.
He's like sitting.
You can almost get an education.
Yeah, he's sitting in the doorway.
It's awful.
And so, you know, I mean, and that exists in Oklahoma, not a place where we would normally think of as we think of the Deep South. But that's the system that existed.
We have just a minute here. The film, am I going to get to see it somewhere?
Yeah, Tell Them We Are Rising. It will be, it's here once again. We're in Salt Lake City today. And then at 5:45, it's at the Yarrow on Saturday. And then it'll be on PBS in the fall.
And then what's next for you?
Well, we're working on a four-part series on Atlantic slavery and the Atlantic slavery and kind of the economics of slavery, and that this was slavery was not just a kind of old pirates, as Bob Marley says, you know, stealing people from Africa and bringing them here, but that it was a system that involved Europe, Africa, the United States, South America, and the Caribbean.
Yeah. So are they saving, is PBS saving your film then for Black History Month?
We're not sure. We're kind of advocating to try to get this thing on in the fall as people go back to school.
School.
We're kind of in a negotiation whether it'll be the fall or February. We're not sure.
Yeah.
Either way, it'll be fine.
Good. Always nice to see you, and thank you for your great film work.
Keep telling the stories.
Sure.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com.
and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
And
listeners like you.
Big thank you to all of my